This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
What if we went around and everyone just said for a minute or two why they posted the... So we're going to be the critical text today, is that right? And people could say why they posted whatever they posted. I mean, like, you may at least get the ball rolling. So well, I guess I'll start since I'm talking already. I chose... I posted the Gwendolyn Brooks piece on Una Mecca. First of all, because that... Brooks's piece itself was so influential in my whole thinking about writing, kind of incorporating place, particularly kind of the collapse of either through deindustrialization or the sort of changing of the city. And I enjoyed the way the author kind of tied in the kind of popular media depiction and the racialization of language in there. And I think it's a really significant move that Brooks makes at that period, you know, where she kind of abandons Harper, who has been publishing her for years, and she has, if you read there's a George Kent critical biography on Brooks, where she where he kind of talks about Brooks's relationship with her white editor, Harper, and the problem with that. There's a lot of correspondence that's reproduced in there. But she makes this move right around the time of the conference at FISP that we were talking about yesterday with Amiri Baratheon and sort of the Black Lives Movement kind of coming forward at that conference. And then she starts publishing with these great little presses, Dudley Randall's Broadside Press in Detroit, Don Lee, Hakeem Abudi's Third World Press in Chicago. And the way that those things, whenever I go to conferences and people start talking about the great little presses of the 60s or that, these presses consistently, almost perpetually, are left off that list. You know, the list becomes, you know, the kind of standard litany of the magazines that were coming out. Surprisingly, at a lot of the conferences, the Tisch and that is left off too, right? So it becomes a kind of predominantly white list of little magazines and presses. So, and I've just been reading Brooks a lot lately, so that's why I posted it.
Just curious about, you mentioned, did you use the word local? I'm not sure, but it seems also there was something about the scale of Brooks's work at that particular moment that was of interest to you. And as in scale, as in where you're living.
Yeah, and sort of that, the critic uses the George Lipset's quote about the poetics of counter memory in there, and sort of writing the counter memory of these neighborhoods that get written a certain way, which is what I do a lot of my own stuff, that get written a certain way in popular media or other media, and so that Brooks's text and other texts like it become sort of a poetics of counter memory for these areas like, you know, say, the east side of Buffalo, which I write about a lot, or the Lackawanna, the industrialized zones in Buffalo, or Bronzeville in South Chicago.
There's a quote in this essay, the temporality of the statement is foregrounded through the question of its locality. To write of a world that no longer physically exists, but a world whose memory is contested, is to raise the question of whom one is writing for. So I assume that locality then becomes tied into questions of both audience and history, past and present.
Do you have a particular reader or constituency or obvious question in some ways, but do you have a reader in mind or a counter memory reader in mind?
Audience?
Well, sort of like the new piece that I read from last night. I talked to some people about this last night a couple times. Is that sort of trying to write a poem that I can simultaneously do an event like this, and that I can do with these sort of labor events that are doing in the Twin Cities or elsewhere, like when we go read a labor notes conference in Detroit or stuff like that. And so like with the new poems, to be able to kind of engage people at the meetings in Minnesota in a way that like if I write about current events, I often feel like I'm kind of preaching to the converted, because like they're either going to be for George Bush or against George Bush or whatever their position will be. Maybe there's a chance to change that, but I don't know if the poem is necessarily a vehicle for that. But if I can talk about kind of anarcho-syndicalism in the Wobblies and say this is the history of labor in Minnesota, and you know that it's not so weird for us to kind of try to bring back some parts of that into the contemporary labor movement, then that seems a way that I can broach those subjects without, hopefully without preaching.
And why do it in poetry?
Well, it's trying to do it through the poem as one small part of these programs that we're doing in Minnesota, so that there'll be a Monday night thing where we'll have people from like say four or five unions come out and talk about what are the problems, particularly the unions that are going through contract negotiations or who are going through someone getting fired because of trying to organize a certain sector, or what's happening to Northwest Airlines. And so we'll have four or five people come out like that. And then we'll have we'll show a film that has some, kind of underpinning labor theme to it, or we'll have some local theater group do a part of a Naomi Wallace play or Clifford of Deaths or something like that. And sort of not expect the mechanic from Northwest Airlines or the meatpacker from Hormel to come out to the bar for the poetry reading, but to integrate the poem into the larger sort of cultural political work of bringing about change.
And also, I'm just going to add what we were talking about this last night, and sort of also it seems to me what I like about that setup is that it's like the normalization of poetry to a certain degree. I mean, it's not this thing, it's part of a process, and so I like that aspect of it too. I mean, so often I feel like it's just this thing, not us necessarily, but the world, the way I was grown up in the United States to think about poetry is this thing up there that people do, maybe they get more inspiration from above. So like that's why I like that aspect of the setup too, the structure of it.
It's what a friend of ours did a reading series at a bar, Patriots Cafe, that was so interesting because it was kind of mixed in with karaoke and all kinds of other things were going on in that bar. And it always felt really exciting, actually, because there would be conversations that would take place that were interesting and unpredictable.
Still doesn't quite answer my question.
Why
cast the history in poetry? I'm just curious what you feel that the form allows you to do that maybe other forms don't, or is it really like you're saying, a question of casting this form specifically for a site in which it's been performed or conveyed to an audience? I'm just curious, that's all.
Yeah, I don't know. I have the ethnomusicology book will be a sort of straighter oral history kind of presentation. And I don't know if I necessarily have an answer why. I mean, that's just the way it kind of has come out so far. I think maybe the sort of straight narrative of writing it as a history book, I don't know how to mix the voices that way. I don't know how to use little parts and fragments of it and to keep it sort of mobile and kind of organized in a movement the way that I can do it in the poem.
I can speak next, Okay, sure. All right. I chose three texts. They were by, and I'm glad going after you because I can try and explain exactly why I didn't choose per se historical texts or why I'm not as oriented towards historical material. The two texts I chose were from Marcel Mauss, the sociologist, anthropologist, Nicholas Luhmann,
recently deceased sociologist, and also Orlando Patterson, who's a socialist at Harvard. But I chose these, I mean, they are highly theoretical, but in part because I'm not as compelled by the dialectic I see, I guess, unfolding very clearly between the local and the global as sort of the model for thinking of social, the place of the social or social activism or something like that. It's less my approach, I think. And I'm more caught by the, I guess, the dialectic between sort of the social as embedded and as characteristic of general habits in the world, life, functions, and then versus the sort of external social, the just social out there, the, I don't know, the general sphere, I mean, you could just call it the world or something like that. So that was more what I was looking at, that balance. And so I chose Maus, who is mostly interested in trying to think of how to connect them from the very beginning. He has this thing called the total social phenomenon, and it's just the idea that one's all of one's activities, movements, are embedded in a social, cultural, political sphere. I mean, that today is obvious, but back then, I guess, was a lot more radical, in the same way that the commentary on the social mark was radical. And then I skipped all the way to Luhmann, who presupposes that in some way, and he wants to talk about systems theory. And I'm not that thrilled, I just thought the questions were excellent about stuff like, I like particularly the question, why is poetry, which is an improbability, or in some sense based on surprise and difference and catching one and sort of, well, exposing one to one off guard, why that becomes probability, why that becomes almost this dead mode of poetic functioning, and what would happen if somehow a key piece of that was taken away in a social sphere. I think it's an excellent question in that. And to some extent, I guess, asks if we're still stuck in the same form of repeating a kind of classical avant-garde in that sense. Just to throw that out. And finally, in the Orlando Patterson was this idea that it wasn't supposed to be like a challenge to the group, and it was just this idea of social death. Many might be familiar with that, but which he used to describe the slave. And he is probably mostly thinking of American slavery, but I just thought that was just an incredible sort of limit of how to think of the social. And I mean, it's something that haunts me, the way he wrote that book in particular. So I just kind of wanted to put that there just to see what happened.
So I posted three sections from Limbaugh's Production of Space, and I think I did that because I think it's discussions of the social easily become theoretical discussions, and for good reason. And I think it's important sometimes to find a way of talking about what that means for people's bodies, moving through different spaces, not the body as an abstract concept, but working, laboring bodies in the different spaces that people move through, social spaces that people move through daily. Transitional spaces, like the subway or the street, and workspaces, obviously, and other kinds of spaces. And so a poetry that's grounded in the social, thinking of it in that way would be a lot different than something not. Particularly, I posted the first one was talking about contradictory space. And the notion of the the traditional avant-garde's working from this they're putting their products or their their works into the dominant social space. In other words, so they're creating what they consider to be dissident works of art and poetry and writing, but they're just being plopped down into this hegemonic space and thereby sort of enforcing it in a way, which I think is an interesting proposition. So not that the 12 of us can change the space that we're putting our works into, but nonetheless that it's really important to think about what that means for the kind of work that we do, whether it is, going out and doing field work or at universities or wherever it is that we're reading. Let's see. Also, I posted an article that was in Documents Magazine called The Search to Merge Culture with the Economy. And I thought that was interesting to sort of extend this idea that that McLeod talks about, the idea of a capitalist space being an abstract space, and the network is a really good example, I think. So, I think the one diagram that I really liked was the star, where one node is a corporate sponsor, another node is maybe a public institution like a university, maybe another node is an artist-run gallery or space, and these networking clubs that obviously were specific to London, but nonetheless I think sort of show a trend that in other places. So what does that mean if we're working in this constructed abstract network space? Not that form is inherently capitalist or anything. So because at the end he sort of begins to talk about how similar modes of modes of organizing were used by some of the early anti-globalization protests, and the article talks about how specifically the carnival against capitalism in London and how they used a star versus sort of mode of organization. And then finally, the last thing I thought that was really interesting was this idea of engagement, using engagement and withdrawal instead of just engagement. I think, especially thinking about a poetics of space, whatever that would be, I mean, there's lots of possibilities, but this idea that I think we're often thinking about how to engage, and sometimes it's also helpful to think of how to disengage certain methods, certain modes, certain forms of address, certain venues. So when does that decision take place to go between something that's going to extend the practice of poetry, like union halls, or there's lots of other possibilities, but when to extend it and when to bring back and talk about like the craft.
And I just thought that article on networks, network clubs, was very interesting, because in some sense that's what this is. It's a networked, not necessarily a club, but it's a networked moment. And the way that person writes about it is to suggest that in fact, there's a desire for these by companies and the extent to which they're just as you were saying, the extent to which they're economically sort of all interlinked at various levels, to the point where the public and the private, the commercial and the non-commercial, the counter hegemonic and the hegemonic are all kind of blurred and interlinked. So in some sense, was the door open for us before we even thought the idea
thought up the idea of, hey, let's open this door and come together for this weekend is something certainly to consider. Particularly the relationship of this kind of networked moment to its own context of gathering Philadelphia and then our own spider web of interconnected spaces elsewhere.
Right, and this idea of us converging over this weekend, and then of course it's obvious that we're all going to go back to our other places, and then that gets disseminated or not, and then we can converge again. One idea that we talked about, which I didn't include, was how to make that more self-conscious, because we're already doing that. We already do this kind of engage and withdrawal and dispersal of information. But, I mean, maybe it's not a question to ask, but is there a way of making it more self-conscious, that process? Would that help or not? I don't know. Maybe it would.
I didn't get to post by the time I, all your guys' posts were coming up. I intended to post this sort of paper, Jules, you might have seen it, that I did for Georgetown, and basically what it was about, it sort of engaged uneven development in terms of the audience. I think what really concerns me in poetry as a writer and reader of poetry is like basically who comes into the door, and to the best of my knowledge is a sort of measurement who is sitting in front of me. It's kind of like what sort of Mark is saying in a way, and the premise, sort of the outline of this paper went like something like this, that obviously we live under capitalism, and not only under capitalism but uneven development, the facts here and abroad. Ergo, you have an uneven cultural terrain that you're dealing with to begin with, and then ergo, how do you act on that uneven cultural terrain? And basically, I came up with this notion. Well, it's not my notion, but I think it's actually Plekhanov who came up with it. One of Lenin's sort of teachers and in the all Russian Social Democratic Party, that whole milieu, and it's the notion of combined struggle. And for me as a poet, what that would mean is that if you have these sort of bifurcations or polarities, like say global versus local, or race versus class, gender, academic versus non-academic, or whatever, not to get caught up in some sort of abstract dialectic on how to sort of how to mediate those, but to just to understand those as different levels of what I call negative receptivity, and I say here the healthy number and degree of negativity that any audience brings with it. So one of my concerns is how not to exacerbate, the uneven cultural terrain, and it has to do very specifically with lexicon. Disposition, initial disposition toward the audience when you begin reading, the moment you you run off the tracks, and so those are my concerns, really. It's just and this is all under the rubric of what I called what I call the social emancipatory imagination, and how to add to that. And that's the way that I understood what you were saying in terms of giving class issues a sort of historical depth and sensibility and tactility and what Jeff has been calling extension into other cultural spheres and tying that up. But those generally is one of my concerns, and hopefully as we go on here today, I'll be able to develop these more.
I'm curious about what you described as the healthy negativity.
I think that, I think for me, it's important to bring to a, well, I'd like to, it's just a series of failures one after the next, but you keep writing to achieve this. I like those contradictions sharpened. That's what I mean by negativity. It's like there's a sort of like, people sit in front of you and they go, yeah, you're a minor, whatever. And so like my thing is to engage that negative reaction, you know, either to make it more pitched or to extend it somewhere. And I try to do that self-consciously. It's not a matter of, but also understanding myself as a subject that's sort of constructed through this uneven development too, right? This unevenly developed attitude. And so I'm in motion too. And so trying to sort of, you know, speak in such a way that motion can be felt, that I'm also moving alongside, but they're in contradiction, but then also about this thing about the social emancipatory imagination, that there's something beyond, that there's something in front of us that we're trying to achieve, and breaking down those barriers. And for me, the attacking capitalism means attacking uneven development, and therefore that's why in the cultural field, an uneven cultural terrain is what I like to sort of register or represent.
Yeah. The poem, one of the poems you read last night, I'm forgetting the name, but it had uneven development and uneven words in it.
Yeah, it was a sort of quasi personification of like me.
But not just you, because you were sort of like pitching out sort of balloons with faces of possibly audience members on them for us to recognize. Mm-hmm.
In that poem, for example, I say the word loofah, right? Like a loofah sponge that you use. You know, who knows what a loofah sponge is? It's a sort of a class mark thing. If you say a loofah sponge to a lot of people who use them, Brooklyn, I don't know what a loofah sponge means. So, or if you say gaffle, what does gaffle mean? Gaffle, you know, you get, it's like a bad drug deal in Brooklyn. And, but it's also a general term for getting sort of ripped off, right? You get gaffled in a deal. You can also get gaffled on other. And so I'm very conscious of the lexicons, and I'm playing, you know, that. At the same time, I want to become reflexive to where my contradictions are also sort of splayed forth. You know, I don't want to just be, you know, some orchestrator, you know, hey, over here, or whatever. And so that...
It makes me think of what you described before as the street heat of the picket line, like bringing some of that to poetry.
Yeah. You mean a crossing, crossing fields, sort of, you know.
I just want to... say, I'm really fascinated by that focus on the codes of perception, to use academic speak. But the code, you know, it's the just the that everything counts and signifies into the poem. And I mean, for that to work, you kind of need to know your audience.
Yeah.
But not just literally who's sitting there in front of you, but also who your poetry antecedents are that you need to address or, you know, do some shadow boxing with. Or, like, for example, in Jules' poem, when you, there's those two lines where you say, in Washington on such and such a date, Joan Retallack said, and then you quote her, and that's a kind of an engagement with a reader, a particular sort of disposition, reading disposition, a particular reception, not only in the past that is shared with others who know Joan's work, but with yourself too, in terms of who you're sort of negotiating with.
Otherwise known as a shadow.
Well, it's not just a shadow, though. It's not like, hi, how are you?
No, but I mean, that's what I think has shadow functions, like to say, this is what I have to respond to. This is the community that I'm in, and maybe I'm crossing something, and maybe I'm setting up a frame.
The shout-out's a good one. You know, so and so in the house, right? Or so and so. It's like as soon as you summon that, or you sort of then it changes the terrain in which you're speaking. So things become charged in different ways. I think once you acknowledge that, those items. So think about the shout out as an interesting thing. If you think about a line as like a shout out, you know, no matter what the hell you're saying, you know, like the thing about to Tina or whatever, or even the most mundane sound that you wouldn't think as a sort of call out, think about it as a call out.
Rodrigo, what's the line in the poem that we had up? Was it shout out to future intersubjectivity?
Yes. Futural intersubjectivities.
It's a
shout out to something, right? Oh, I think this thing too is interesting about the antecedents. I think that for me, it's important not to, you know, to. I understand like Marx doing it in a very different context, but how do you keep the argument going? Would say like your poetic antecedents and the issues that are still embedded and that stuff, and also bring up issues that affect people's lives and their life structures, right?
But that's the argument.
And how do you come? For me, it's how you combine those struggles. And that's to me the difficulty of poetry.
But in some ways, that's the argument at the level of form too. Yeah. One's antecedents.
I love that.
Wait, where's the reason?
Antecedents.
Antecedents.
Oh.
And so if it's an argument, what fascinates me, just shut me up if you don't like this or want to move on to some other subject, but it's an argument of form, at the formal level, because it's like you're deciding, to shout out to Joan Retallack in your poem, with all the sort of implications that raises.
The word discrimination, like a discrimination of...
Right.
Of not only particular words, but
yeah.
Ways of sort of gesturing, those words, That's why this terms that's going on, the flarfing, the thing that people go on the Google and they're just pulling down languages and putting them together.
Right.
And to me, that's like, you're pulling all these different words that are sort of beholden to all these different uneven cultural things. And what you might be doing is again exacerbating the uneven cultural terrain, and therefore you're not mitigating.
Just aestheticize how uneven is the breadth.
Yeah.
But what I wanted just to say is that so it's an argument of form, but it's totally worked out in on the level of reception, on the level of content.
Mm-hmm. You talk about double negativities a lot. I mean, you said, what do you mean by that? Negative, healthy number of negative, negativities. But this thing of uneven cultural terrain, uneven development causes, us to have stacked negativities. Not that, that's bullshit, everything's bullshit.
Yeah.
But how do you engage that, like, this negativity, and how do you complexify how somebody's going to hear, receive, how do you carve out a space by chipping away at all these, I like...
Even crafting a sort of a frustrated journey through like this terrain where you come to an end stop, you come to he's stuttering at the level right in the middle of a word, or there's different ways. Everybody here does it in completely different ways, but that's all I have to say for now.
Maybe I'll go next because I put something by Joan Retallack in, so it's interesting connection. And that I read this about 5 years ago, and this paragraph stuck with me. I think she's talking about, she's being interviewed, and she's asked about a question of audience and avant-garde, and then she gives her response. And I think it's stuck with me because I feel like sometimes it satisfies me and sometimes it completely does not satisfy me. And I think it's interesting in terms of what Laura's pieces are about space too, in the sense that maybe part of the way it satisfies me is that she's talking about a way for the avant-garde to occupy a space that's not the hegemonic space. And so in that sense, with the small audience, it's necessary. In a way of sort of dodging co-optation and placing a wager, that this will make a difference. But then where it doesn't satisfy me is more what Mark is addressing, in terms of audience. So that's why I put this piece on there, is because it's stuck with me.
Let's Okay, that's an interesting term, God in co-optation, because I think that that is a kind of a widespread goal within people working in small press poetry, probably broader small community art, independent art. But the text that I posted from Adona, the couple of side notes that I mentioned in my email to the group earlier in the week is about identity. I think it's really interesting that they're an anonymous collective, and I assume that members probably come and go for different projects as they will. And so I don't know. It troubles me because I don't think that culturally we're quite ready for that. Because if I had a bet, I know that like Jan Lovink is a member of the Dilma, who's a Dutch thinker. I would guess that the group is probably mostly male European Caucasian. But so I don't know that we're quite ready for like a lack of assertion, a balanced cultural identity. But I do think that we're sort of ready to let go of the sort of ego of being an artist, which like it or not, I mean, I think that we've all grown up with and been schooled with and encountered in our various intellectual and artistic circles. But I think that like the Dodging Collaboration is part of that identity crisis that we're all in, because we all are really anti-hegemony, anti-power, hierarchical power. But I think that it can be counterproductive, because what I really like about the media archive piece from Adona is that it says, like, forget the archive and act, intervene. And I think that it behooves us to like accept the power that we have and take license with that and leverage that to actually become the media. I mean, I love this clamor phrase, but you know, to really occupy space, like locate the spaces that we can occupy and get in there and assert that. And furthermore, I mean, what do we want that space to look like, and then what do we want collective identities to look like? I think that we all have expressed that there might be some, you know, imbalances there too. What does our outreach look like? But so the Adilno piece that I really value it for, it's called To Act. And just intervene and don't think of things for I don't know. It's a tricky balance. I mean, they're anti-archive. I don't think I don't know whether or not they would be anti-history or not, but I certainly wouldn't be. And Mark, I think that what you're doing with historical labor movements, putting them in contemporary media, is really powerful. So I don't think that the two are mutually exclusive. And then just quickly, Alan, I think your question of why poetry is going to like be haunting at least me all weekend, if you just put it on the table. I can say for myself that like I can't really answer that, because poetry and the pleasure of the text, it's all like a drug. I mean, you know, like we're doing it already. So, you know, that sort of being our cross to bear, as it were, what do we want it to look like? So I think instead of asking why poetry, it would be more like how poetry.
That was the implication. I mean, I wasn't questioning the impulse. I was just curious as to what form allows you to do that other forms that you also write in and you write in don't allow you to do. It certainly wasn't any way meant to be that.
You know, for me, that's a question of political economy, not just a form as well. Because I do, I'll just intervene and jump in for a moment, because I do lots of art writing. I'm writing about architecture and urban space now, and it can barely use the word ideology. It gets out of the gout. So places are so contained, it's unbelievable. So I mean, that's when, for me, it's not why poetry, but it's why culture at all.
I mean, you can't use the word ideology because it's too, it's like a
Our readers don't get that.
It's too theoretical. And like, listen.
One of the things, I mean, when you ask the question, it's interesting because it's almost as an attempt to build a different poetry audience is what I'm interested in doing. And I know that, like, so I'm glad to be here this weekend, because I don't want to speak for you, but when we, Rodrigo and I did my piece on kind of labor stuff and, you know, field work and that, and Rodrigo did this on border zones.
In D.C.,
yeah, Georgetown. And it was like dropping a brick into a still body of water, watching it sink to the bottom, and just nothing happening afterwards.
The beach of the new coast.
Yeah.
That's right. And it was like, I know I did mine, you know, and there was not a single word that when I finished talking to the end of the panel, an hour later, I didn't say another word.
Yeah.
The rest of the time, because it got sort of co-opted by about making books out of your dryer lint and stuff like that.
This is at university?
Yeah.
And even development turned into hybridity or something like that.
Yeah. And both of the ideas. And so that brought up, like, you know, Alan's piece that he posted and read a little bit yesterday, you know, and, like, sort of putting the poem into the space of, like, people who are suddenly all politicized about their poetry, you know, and then, you know, but if you talk about, and we talked about this last night at the bar a little bit too, you know, it's like, how can we tap this energy of the anti-war movement, which will probably disappear at some point in the future. I mean, I don't want to be a pessimist about it, but, you know.
Hopefully
not. Okay. And, you know, so, like, at the things we do, these Monday night things, we try to have, like, one or two anti-war people speaking, or people from Women Against Military Madness or something like that, but to have it in the context of the sort of labor speakers club, you know, so hopefully when people come out for the anti-war stuff, they hear the labor stuff and, you know, we can kind of get back into the anti-globalization movement and we can, you know, kind of tie it to all of that stuff together. But in the poetry world, it's kind of spooky. Go and drop the brick and watch it sink, and there's no, it's not even a ripple on any coast.
Well, I think that that's the problem with working in the margins, is that our communities can sometimes feel so hermetic, and I think that there can sometimes be a level of contentment with saying, oh, no one appreciates us, oh, no one listens, and no one wants to reach out. Well, you know, then we have to reach out. That's an interesting problem that results from that.
Yeah, I like this idea of building.
Mark, you're also talking about a kind of ideological containment of content in a way within. So, I mean, that's, to use the reaching out term, that's kind of reaching out is a way not only to articulate to other communities, but to get out of a bind that you're in within an existing one that you have. So, I mean, I'm sure those of us who write about class issues and we're joking about it on the bus on the way down after you do a reading and then someone will come up to you and tell you how utterly stupid or magic it was that you're talking about class within a poem. And then it's like, well,
ontological.
It's just like some totally romantic idea, but it's just like what you think the...
Class doesn't exist anymore,
Joe. It's like what you think the working class is living, ontologically privileged site where the world's going to change from or something like that. And then these are the same people who, like, claim some interest in globalization. One of the stark statistics of globalization is over the last 30 years has been a doubling of wage laborers. So actually you could argue that class is pretty central to globalization, as is urbanization.
Not to mention the feminization of labor.
Of labor, super exploitation, feminization, dot dot for a very blocky call out. But and then I think you know, that tends to get obscured within the global local, which is like almost, to me, that's kind of more like a slogan that's maybe applicable to Verizon than it is to actual organizing. So that's why I posted a couple things that I put up was the scale debates from within critical geography, which try to find an adequate scale for organizing socially and culturally. And also I wanted to set up a bit of a dialogue with Laura's pieces, which were up earlier, with the Jameson piece that talks about the merge, the discursive merge, at least, of culture and the economic, what I've been calling the collapse of the cultural into the economic, which then drops the social away. So you lose the social as a site. And it's like, to me, the ultimate failure of the base superstructure argument is you end up losing the social. There's nowhere to act. So I try and recuperate that by spatializing it and particularizing it through the scale debates. So
can I ask you that way? Like, I mean, the economic-cultural connections are not new. I mean, that's clearly been the origin of any cultural production. It's always been connected. But, I mean, are you... Like in your poems, when you
cite the number of barrels. Was it exported from the countries or imported?
Imported to the U.S.
Imported to the U.S.
Exported.
Are you trying to switch on and just disentangling that? Are you trying to push that into level of form somehow? I'm just wondering, because your poetry, I wanted to say that I see attention on the level of, you're trying to, undo many of these processes at one time, but the form itself isn't being undone in a way that I would have imagined in a way, I don't know, I don't know, I'm picking them as well, but, you keep some sort of stability in the poem to some extent, especially them being sort of, units of thoughts in some way.
The way that I asked Jeff about this on the way down about what, because I didn't know exactly what the numbers referred to, but I knew that they appeared sort of at certain times in the poem. I think what's interesting about that is that instead of talking about context as some sort of passive backdrop, there's a sort of political economic rhythm that you
of get numbers.
Of numbers. And the sort of particular capitalist sectors that appear in a sort of, they shimmer throughout the poem. So he can insert cultural moments in that sort of dynamic context. And so we get it in motion where we need to be if we're going to attack it. Perfect. I promised I wouldn't use that word attack. Engage.
But in some sense, also just to tap onto that, question of the stable articulatory sentence, right? It's like subject, verb, object, bang, when Rodrigo used the word self-consciousness, I think very much in some sense that's what we're struggling to articulate in our work, I think, is a kind of self-reflexive attention to one's limits. The limits of the various social registers that one evokes through the words that we use.
I'm 30 years older than the term. Mm-hmm. Those kind of perfect.
And that's that's this taking seriously that your identity is constructed from the outside. And what is it? The first one I started with that is from an earlier poem. In my lifetime, I've seen the creation of the self-serve gas station. And then, which is kind of a toss-off line, but from that, I start thinking,
who are you?
I'm 300 years younger than the word ideology, and I kind of work from that. But with me, I'm not trying to separate out again the economic and the cultural, but I'm trying to look at how the merging, the surge to merge, or the collapse, which would be different within different registers with different forces, how that creates the social. And then out of that, then what is the role of the cultural? So actually, at this moment, don't think so much what's the specific role of poetry. So, why poetry? But because I've been outside in a way of the cultural field that I have been working, and I'm working more with materialist Marxist geographers and urbanists and political scientists who don't consider the cultural. So it's always every week during the seminars it gets near the end of the 2 hours or almost an hour and 35 minutes, and I'm okay, so how do we think of the cultural in this? It's it's almost like the snooze button thing. I wake up, I say it.
Snooze button.
Finally, after 2 years, it finally broke through when we had this thing at the Brecht Forum a couple of weeks ago, and again, 2 hours talking with the cultural being talked about, and then this forum on new forms of imperialism. So I talked about I just used the classic Lenin stage theory of imperialism to read culture through, but then to ask what can the cultural do today? What's the role of it? And but then also, if people are literally talking about transforming society, that's the amazing thing at CUNY at the moment, is you're in a grad seminar, and with about 25 minutes to go, they stop and say, okay, how are we going to take this knowledge and transform society? And nobody stops and says, that's stupid, it's never going to work, it's the best we can do is have, maybe change your own consciousness or something, or dismiss it. People totally take it seriously. So that ideological horizon has been won somehow over the last couple of years. community, which it's totally fascinating to be in because people, it totally energizes people. Everyone's much more involved, it seems, in different kinds of activist work. But they don't have a way of thinking about the cultural. And it's not
only
the poetic.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to isolate the poetic part of it. I would just make that part of the cultural front. In a way, I think maybe Mark is thinking about this one.
And I think that in terms of like breaking that sense of hermeticism, that's a really powerful tool, and it allows us to like cross connect with people working in other genres, which is only logical.
And then why I'm not just like trying to address sort of once the question of like why I'm not like I do in other work, but in this work why I'm not trying to crack form below the level of the sentence. Or at the level of the sentence. So I take seriously the idea of poetry as information and coming from the, particularly Yuri Lotman had a big influence on me, structuralist linguist, but I think, so take those ideas like poetry as information, not a privileged form of information, but a social form of information, which links more to the idea of poetry as a media, and then the media is in the U.S. anyway, and in Canada as well, unfortunately, it's like so clamped down, it's so narrow, and the view of the world that gets so unbelievable at times that even just having a space of hope to fucking say stuff that is almost so obvious to everybody else in the world, that's maybe the why poetry for me. But then it's also the why not art criticism, because as soon as you say it gets edited out.
I have a question, and maybe it's we can ignore this question, which would be fine if it catapults us back in some kind of hypothetical space. But I'm not bashing theory. I'm just saying, like, I like this. But what is the role of the cultural if we think of this merge of culture and economy, what you say is lighting is social. So, you know, do we think of the cultural as a way of, bringing back the social, bringing the social to visibility? I mean, what's the relationship between the cultural and the social then?
Well, I mean, there's been that argument of culturalization that Samin Amir, because we were talking about him last night at the bar, that the cultural expanse as a category, everything becomes cultural. And one example that gets used is that the war in Bosnia was seen as like this cultural clash, when in fact you could actually just simply look at the economy and see that it was an economic clash. And then it was also structured within the geography of capital accumulation. But then culture becomes this cloaking agent to the real reasons why it happens. So much happens, that cause and effect gets split off so much into globalization.
Right.
So in some ways it is kind of to reclaim the social or make the social again visible, but it's also to retool the cultural towards other ends as well. I mean, Zizek argues that what happens in that formulation is that the political drops away, and all you have is the cultural. So.
I want to touch on something that Kristen submitted, Emil Alcalais, from The War Infections. I don't think that this point was in the excerpt that she posted, but one point that he brings up in that conversation with Ben is, you know, like we witnessed two genocides in the last decade, and it's nowhere to be found in the poetry that we're producing. So when I think about cultural in that sense, I think about consciousness. And that consciousness being brought to social decisions, and maybe I'd like to hear what you think about this, being in the history of consciousness program in finance. But thinking about, you know, documenting that and bringing it to art and culture, I think that certainly does inform social action and social decisions.
I just want to not to switch the subject, but maybe this is related to you, but you used the word hermeticism. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate a bit on how you were using it.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, that was just coming off of Kaya's mentioning of Joe's crisis, that she often feels that it would be being in an avant-garde community, you're in a very small, very limited audience. And so that's all I mean by that. I think that, you know, I think that just very generally, many of us working in small press poetry and venues feel like we don't really have a whole lot of connection to a larger world, that a lot of people aren't really paying attention to what we're producing.
It's like, yeah, okay, I was imagining something else then, because a hermetic, like, address would maybe be, you might want to contrast that with, like, one that's more articulatory, kind of.
I was thinking more public.
No.
How about more populist?
More populist, that's awesome.
So not hermetic as in, like, HD or...
No.
No, I mean, that's not the term.
I mean, I think it's also not just, you know, right, we've already been discussing, it's not just the issue. I mean, very much an issue of, you know, audience or institutional apparatuses that construct our audiences and which we often can, you know, buy into or contest in different ways, but also what we're talking about in terms of lexicons, in terms of what happens when you bring class to a contemporary avant-garde poetry context. And it's and also the idea that to say class means the working class, as if like there aren't classes, you know, as if there's not already a bourgeois class too that constitutes most of our audience too.
And that's why it gets dismissed as post-romantic.
And that's, I don't know if romanticism is right word there, but again, it's a sense of shared institutional constraints that we all become complicit in at the same time. What feels allowable to say in any given context, and so that is in addition to the struggles around reaching out and broadening communities and these networking things, I think is crucial. But also, this has already been kind of repeating what people have said, but that exploding that from within, bringing some of those also into the space. It's like it or not, I mean, you do, you often function in these small scenes, and they provide, I mean, as much as everyone complains about them, they provide an incredible degree of a kind of safety, because it's easy, because, everyone knows, we're not visual artists, so we don't have to worry about corporate sponsorship. So we can have this sort of, we often hear this, outside of commodity circle or as if the logics of exchange value have nothing to do with poetry because only 300 people reach a bar, that's a lot of this kind of thing. I think this is something that I already sort of know these things, but that it's also not just sort of like, well, we know, it's those other poets who aren't as political as us, we're as much implicated in that as well. That's why I think this idea Rodrigo and others talking about in terms of, staging the crisis is not quite the right element, it's a dramatic element to it, diving into working through crises and contradictions as opposed to sort of, I picked this phrase up from you right here a couple of years ago, surfing the contradictions, which is a sense of sort of like, there's this, and I'm just going to show you how it all connects or disconnects, because these are the contradictions at play, but somehow one's own positionality or the positionality of the columnist, somehow, you construct this space as if, as opposed to like really implicating oneself and the work itself within as its own set of overdetermined contradictions and crises at work. I think we talked about this yesterday too, in terms of really thinking of the contemporary moment, a lot of our shared concerns is very much coming out of these notions of crisis, the crisis of form, to think about the political in the space of cultural work. Obviously, self-reflexivity and self-consciousness and presencing that in one's work, but even that becomes its own sort of like tired aesthetic strategy in some sense. I'm still aesthetic strategy.
Tired.
Yeah, and the same thing happens in you know, the academy or like, you know.
The union halls too.
Really?
Tired, same old shit.
Yeah.
I mean, all the time.
Well, it's kind of like what Kristen was saying yesterday. About, you know, in a very, the role of the cultural in these anti-war protests, for example. I mean, if you have the same speech 30 times throughout the day, and it's the same words, and it's the same affect, and it's the same content, how do you, you know, when does that stop?
Is that articulation?
Right. Does it have any content after a certain point?
Like the word oil, you know, if you know,
it's
just a sound, like in Kristen's
poem. I think that one of the things that I'm sure you've all experienced, you know, when after you read something, there's obviously, you know, people who are, you know, co-producers who come up to you and say, well, I like your piece, blah, blah, blah. But there's also the people who don't know who they are come up to you and give you real comments or seem to be really interested, you know, what I've been calling in my poetry the interloper, which to me is a positive entity. You know, like, and you don't know why that person is there or why they walked in or why they're interested in culture. I think your emphasis on culture is good in that way. They're not interested in poetry per se, but they're interested in the cultural things that you're saying. And lately, Alan has been sort of developing this. I'm not going to articulate this too well, but you know, what if we were to get more sort of accurate reads on what we're getting back? You know, he suggested that in your sort of critique of active reader theory, that it's not just the text doing the manipulation or bringing the audience into being in some sort of like sort of magic, ontological magic or whatever. But you know, what are they thinking? What are they bringing to the table? And how do we find out? Even sort of empirically, like finding out who these people are, and then working back that way. And then Mark, you mentioned that Brecht at the Georgetown conference, that you had a really good quote about Brecht, that his theater was about, you know, when people walked into his plays, that they wouldn't leave their intellect, and, well, how did you say it?
They put their brains in their hats.
They put their brains in their hats, checking at the door, and that's it, and it's all over, you know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, there's nothing central here that I'm trying to say, just to sort of tie in a few.
Let me just configure this in poetic terms. This focus on audience critique of active reader theory, which is kind of like what the generation before us was about, the open reader, the inviting a space in the text for the reader to imagine active reading engagement. It's like as if this has become now literally the ground of one's readership, of people who are in the room listening to you, that you inscribe in your work, too, if there's Joan Metallica or something like that. I mean, in some way, it's like taking the New York School model of the social network, the scene, and politicizing it. Because, like, in a New York School poem, speaking in general terms, it's not, like, it's hermetic, not in the sense that, I imagine you were meaning. Like, it's hermetic in the sense that it's like, you know, and they drop first names, Ron, this, that, the other, and it's like, oh, it's this great oozy schmoozy kind of like social sort of partying scene that's sort of evoked in this sort of like first person unselfconscious way. It's like, I'm not interested in being self-reflexive about the social, the political, etc. I just want to have a good time in my poem and sort of like end, you know, without a period at the end of my sentence, you know, And it's like what in some way, I mean, I'm just thinking in my, you know, sort of very limited, ethereally theoretical way, which is my contribution to this, that, you know, it's like taking the New York School idea of social, which is completely asocial in the sense that they're not really interested in being conscious about what it means to constitute a collectivity, and actually politicizing it.
I have a number of questions in regard to that. I mean, you just said it was a social network, so why are they not conscious about collectivity? It seems it's all about being conscious of the collectivity. Second of all, I'm very wary of only allowing ourselves to read certain kinds of poetry, political, and certain kinds of poetry, not politically. Why can't we bring the astute modes of reading that we are applying to each other's work to other forms of poetry, and then, based on that reading, decide whether or not something's political? I mean, you're talking about a community of gay men in the 50s in New York City. You can't possibly tell me that at some level this is not a political... This is not a political community and a political mode of writing and a political mode of forming an alternative to dominant modes in society. I mean, that's a general reading of a general movement. I mean, I think you can certainly argue about individual authors and individual poems and things like that, but I'm just a little hesitant to kind of go in that way.
Yeah, I wasn't really thinking of a little bit of the 50s, but I was thinking more of the
second generation, maybe.
Third, or,
so, okay, well, that's different. Sorry, I just assumed New York School, 50s, Franco era. But, yeah, it changes. It certainly changes in the late 60s with the later generation. But again, you know, we're all aware of the working class backgrounds of certain second generation New York School figures, and I would certainly say that plays a part in the poetry of the time. And Kirsten's been reading Diane de Prima's autobiography and being pregnant and just kind of amazed at, you know, the way Diane de Prima, for instance, went through pregnancy and motherhood, you know, on the fringes of a fringe of a kind of social predicament that I don't think many of us in this room or many people would at this point in time allow themselves to even experience. So I don't want to collapse the economic and the cultural in a certain way, but at the same time, I can't not see that as a political
expression,
for sure. Now we can frame it in certain ways in relation to other situations, but you know, having your baby at a free clinic with no prenatal or no follow-up is maybe it's the norm in today's society. Maybe it's not so fringe. Maybe that is, in fact, how the majority of children are delivered in a non-healthcare-providing U.S. society. That's certainly a political experience, I think.
I mean, for me, one of the most interesting political poetry journals in the last while was Bent magazine. It did have a very distinct ideological role, which was to the total financialization of poetry. It's like, how can we get into the mainstream? How can we mainstream avant-garde poetry incredibly quickly through the financialization of poetry? So they did like classic. I mean, it's like I want to write about France and globalization because they pick up macroeconomic strategies and apply it to this little avant-garde community in order to slide it into the total financialization of everyday life. So it's like right away. They set up Govina contests, and then and the only way they had valuing anything was through its massification. So, like, you got a mention in a mass culture in a mass magazine, and that was seen as the ultimate value. So it's a very distinct political. I mean, it's in a green sense, extremely distinct and unfortunately effective political campaign.
Well, but the interesting thing is, I mean. I don't know, I don't want to get too down on fence, but I've been directly appealed to by his editors to purchase the magazine of Barnes & Noble. Yeah. And so in that very gesture, it ceases to be avant-garde or even anything I value. Because that's an incredibly political move that I think undermines the credibility of what might be avant-garde in it.
Having it appear in Barnes & Noble?
No, being asked to purchase it. Like
if you're going to buy it by there.
Why? Because they pulp it if they have copies left over, which my response is, well, then don't distribute to.
Barnes & Noble pulps it, or they're distributing?
Barnes & Noble.
So it counts in sales? Is that why?
Well, because, okay, so if I buy my copy at Barnes & Noble instead of from the press directly, then those issues won't get pulled, and then the economy of the magazine is ultimately stronger. So if you're going to buy it anyway, please buy it at Barnes & Noble.
You buy it at Barnes & Noble, well, Fence gets 50% less than
the distribution, I guess the economy
distribution. Well, no, smaller.
Yeah, no.
Small, I mean, independent distributors pull too. We had XDM pulled for a couple of years, I don't know.
I don't know, my dad worked in a cult, and I like cults.
I think it's important to go back to this thing about uneven development, uneven cultural terrain, because I see these, for example, one of the things, Louis, that you set up in your initial comments to the group was this idea of the opposing terms of form and content. I mean, is that a reality? Do we have to talk about form? Is it more formal contents of form, and how do we go between those or negotiate those terms, but at the same time recognize that they don't always divide into these two things. The same with the avant-garde, what you're saying, and I think like what you meant by like a hermetically sealed community is sort of how I read what you were saying, which is one way that the avant-garde has been seen, that we're just this isolated number of people and our whatever we write is just being circulated within that. But I don't think that that's really really how it works. I mean, maybe that's not the ideal, and probably nobody in here would say that's an ideal. So what is this relationship between, can we have these hardcore communities where we, as craftspeople, discuss ideological and political craftspeople discuss these things from that kind of a real theoretical perspective, yet at the same time, it doesn't have to be that's the only audience for it. I mean, obviously, like as you said, there's interlopers. There were interlopers here last night. I mean, people.
You recorded on
that. I withdraw the motion.
There were Smurfs here.
No, I got.
I mean,
blue Smurfs.
But that kind of isolation of whether it's the avant-garde or whether it's isolation of poets, or in Fence's case, which I'm saying it's not just Fence, but other formations, is that it's the avant-garde's accumulation strategy. I mean, this kind of isolation only works if you disarticulate poets or writers from the social. So how is it you spend like 3 hours a day, 3 hours a week, say, writing poetry, and that becomes somehow that activity is enough to disengage you from every other thing that you do, and then you're supposed to think of this thing isolated in this way. It's only if you take writers outside of the social and place them into a cultural that's not articulated to the social that you can think of it as being isolated. It's like, no, it's not like we don't have other aspects of our lives.
I think that one problem that often comes up in writing, and in particular, well, I don't know, I want to address some things that Mark and David posted earlier about being conscious of our references, and Emil says, and from the Warring Factions, and again, I don't remember if this is what it was in what Kristen posted, but that frankly, a lot of people in small press U.S. poetry communities are reading the wrong tags, and that many of us have read a lot of French continental theory, myself included, and I don't discredit that at all. Like, it's very wonderful, but that can be very exclusive. I mean, it's disingenuous to say, although I think that every one of us who reads those texts say, oh, but you don't need specific knowledge to really understand the ideas. Like, I would say that as well, but I think that that's somewhat disingenuous because, it's not necessarily, the references aren't necessarily intuitive, per se. So how do we address that problem of producing texts that aren't exclusive, that sort of evidence of extensions?
Yeah, I'd follow up on that just by saying that, kind of maybe relating back to what I said at the end yesterday,
you know, if the social, I mean, again, I totally agree with Jeff. Of course, every poet, what they're doing is social, and it's not that the poetry is social and the life is social. It's, you know, we're talking about a larger package, but I just think we need to be careful about using social in a blanket term, because it doesn't give us an ability to make distinctions within sociality, or within different strategies that people employ, or different degrees in which they're self-conscious about this, or, you know what I mean, or the different texts that they read, or the different communities that they're a part of, because, you know, there are distinctions to be made that assuming the social is a general category is not going to lend itself to, I think.
No, that's why I try and bring it on scale.
Well, I was just going to say, so that's interesting. So I would say, you know, gradations or scale. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's the way to move the discussion to a certain extent.
But also to sort of be aware that those are also just relegations too. Those spaces, you know, to be aware that they're not just like liberatory, you know, expression, but that they're relegated spaces that need to be contested. I mean, whatever. Because those
95% of the time, I would think, at least.
Yeah, I'm just kind of adding to it.
Yeah, definitely. Right.
Can I pick up a couple things from where I come from? And I don't want to say these are antagonistic points, but I'm actually, well, the two things, I want to talk about Emil's argument too, but for me, actually, I'm very attracted to the idea of the Hermetic. That's something to me that somehow is compelling in my work and in my thought, and including if I happen to read more French writers than anything else. But and I'll say why I got there. But it doesn't scare me that poetry would be Hermetic in a way. In fact, I mean, I'm more interested in how the social produces Hermetic spaces in general, and I want to track that as much as I'm interested in just seeing how uneven development is also a category of the social. But and I'm definitely not worried that poetry would be seen as Hermetic at a certain point, because I think that's, it's got a lot of, I mean, there's a lot to explore there no matter what. And then counter to that, when Emil says that he's astonished by maybe the limited scope of the writing, I mean, he is in such a wonderful and privileged place to have personal and historical connections to the work in Bosnia, to the work in the Middle East as well. And he has these wonderful connections that I've always been in awe of. I don't know if I've met anyone in my life who's ever had that many. But those are very difficult to generate. How do you not generate them arbitrarily? How do you generate them somehow with more than just an attachment of representation? I mean, I'm not interested in representing in sort of field representation and give everyone a voice and something like that. And Emil does it great because he's not doing it in that way. I mean, he's got this sort of almost organic, network that he's building. But
the thing I hear what you're saying, your emphasis. The thing that I would think that is like, then what's managing, you know, the Hermetic activity? If the Hermetic activity, if it's not actively engaging, you know, its affairs, so to speak, or its concerns, like that, to the larger world, then what's managing it? Let me give you a sort of an analogy, and it's the same sort of little story that we talked about when we were famous about bus ride that keep referring to. I'm also working. He's using the other bus, but we have to get a cell phone. This discussion is so, to me, is so interesting. I just hope there's something to talk about in front of these people out here. You know, we have to literally recreate some of this stuff. I mean, the way I'm thinking about it now, that's the concern that's sort of building up. But we can do it sort of that way. But in
well, I thought we're just lip syncing. We're just going to play. That's why it's going to take. It's more the choreography.
I'll leave it at that, Josh. I'll leave it at that. I'm not going to go into this.
I want to know what you were saying.
Well, maybe it's an analogy in sort of labor and ideology that it's not applicable, but I'm just going to put it out there. In some of the work that we do at the Labor Institute, we study strategies to combat adaptation. In other words, like the bargaining unit from being co-opted into, you know, management's prerogatives or something. We really specifically...
Internalization is another way of saying it?
Yeah, the way they internalize certain precepts or whatever. And this is interesting because of, we do actual surveys, Alan, which is interesting what you've been talking about. we actually ask people, when you hear this sentence, what do you think? What does it mean for you? We actually tabulate. We get a feel for the bargaining unit's overall aggregate ideological disposition towards management and power. And one of the things that we discovered was that at what seemed at first good was that they were, you know, a lot of the workers, some of the top workers, were saying the trust union, they were saying, I don't want to be management. I don't want to be management. And we thought, oh, this is great, you know, because now they're going to be in the bargaining unit, they're not going to move up, they're going to keep these good brains and skills. And then when we dug a little deeper, we started discovering that they were against managing not only, they were against managing their affairs. Yeah. You know, they were against managing anything. They, in other words, they took this little work, this relegation, this hermetic space, and within this space they had a certain amount of freedom. Do you know what I'm saying? And so they didn't want to manage. That's what they were saying. Is I don't want to lose this little freedom, but it's that little box, what we call the work box later on, that prevented you know, sure. A larger, you know,
Managing
a larger sort of counter-hegemonic
not
strategy.
Not managing people.
Yeah, managing people. And so,
not managing.
Well, do they see management as just a more constricted work box? I mean, if your possibility is to jump from a work box where you have a certain limited degree of freedom, I think probably a lot of us could, you know, as freelancers or part-timers or whatever we do, we all see in some ways the value of that.
Yeah.
I don't want to jump into a box where I have less freedoms, more responsibilities, and maybe I make more money, but in the end, I'm just curious, does that turn up in your surveys? Is that a thought, a component of
yeah, maybe
of
maybe
this
it's
kind
a
of thing. I mean,
I think it also applies in office work. You know, we started thinking about this in
different
small offices,
office. Uh-huh.
And you know, I started saying that, you know, I only wanted to do certain things, and I didn't want to get involved with the budget over here.
Right.
And it also had you could also apply it, but I think it's a larger context. But the thing about the hermetic, you have hermetic is fine with me. I mean, it's hermetic instances, whatever. But like to sort of embrace hermeticism for me as a poetic, like that's what I would think about.
And I like when you start out with it as sort of an original unit, and then you see it replicated, and then you expand it, and you can able to allow they might function. I mean, what their interests are, and how they might be more connected. You know, see themselves as.
But your hermetics are like talking about science stuff, right? Like a lot of science.
No, not necessarily. I'm just saying, any given job that we all do, we have these little hermetics that we do that make our job, I don't know, sort of something that we, I don't know, just implant in ourselves and something like that. I want to look at that too in that way. I'm just attracted to that, and that's not a fact of connection.
Well, can we look at like an urban space as maybe. Like a map of interconnected, overlapping hermetic spaces. I know that sort of goes against what hermetic means, but I mean, for example, when I go to my job, you know, in East Harlem, like I'm in East Harlem in projects, that's sort of a hermetic space, sort of. And then, you know, going to back to the subway on 86th Street, that's a very different sort of hermetic space. I mean, in other words, different codes are used there, and if you don't use those codes, then you know, you're policed in some fashion. So, like, yeah, these spaces, these hermetic spaces do exist. And I think one of the things that is interesting, maybe you're saying this, is that we have to understand what those spaces are.
Yeah.
So it's important to delve into these. Like, and I think that's maybe one of the things that I was interested in studying, or I don't know how to say, in some of my pieces, were how are they related, in other words. So if this hermetic space here, let's shake it up, let's see what's there, you know, and all this, and how is it related to this one over here? I mean, I'm using the analogy of the urban space because I think it's easy to see, but I mean, I think they exist in language too, and how, and in literature, in various forms, but also in lexicons. And for example, you know, if I go to a, you know, to see a hip hop band, that's linguistically a hermetic space. Versus, you know, if I go and see a poetry reading at this gallery, versus Now I'm getting a little bit.
I agree with everything you're saying completely. I'm just not sure if hermetic's quite the right word at this point for what we're talking about. These are just...
Okay, yeah, you're right. I'm just figuring out.
Isn't it like a message, like, you know, from Hermes, like, is that hermetics? Is that what we're talking about?
Like a contained hermetic message
in a poem you're willing to...
I'm
I think one way in which all our poetries overlap is being interested in social codes. I mean, I think that's definitely that everyone in this room is playing with in different ways. You know, what are the social codes? And specifically, not just one social code, but a multiplicity of social codes and how those deciphered, left undeciphered, how are they related, unrelated, how do they cross back into time, how do they gesture towards the future. So I mean, I think that's a good analogy. I'm just not sure if we should keep that word at this point.
Well, I think it's interesting, I mean, thinking about just enclosed space of safety, basically, that you mentioned, and then going from there outward, or do you stay in the box that you're describing? I like that analogy, but eventually, like, going, are we going to go outward at all? That's a really important question. I mean, it takes it back to your original question about what is social animal. And, like, for me, when I start thinking about this, I want to break it down a little bit, you know, like, and I, like, just like you're doing right now. Like, can we say explicitly certain modes or methods? I mean, you talked about this in the first day, too, about reception versus form. I like sort of taking it in that direction because then I think it enables us in certain ways to engage the cultural struggles that you're talking about and we're all talking about, you know, like being explicit about social methods, like just like you know, I was talking to Kristen yesterday. I mean, another thing that I think really runs through a lot of the work that I read in preparation for this in terms of the poetry is what she was discussing as investigative poetics yesterday and like dipping into sources and using them in interesting ways. I mean, how many of the things that we read were sort of concerted cobblings of different sources? And so, like, I see that as, like, a social method, one of the ways in which it's a social method. And I'd be interested in hearing hopefully, other ways, very concrete, you know, I'm asking really concrete questions.
I'm glad you picked up that there, because one thing that I've been wondering is whether or not we can answer the question of whether or not we're interested in crossing many social codes, let's say, many stratas of that, is what are our goals? I mean, I think that it's probably obvious that we all hold a greater economic parity as a goal, and so I think that we need to really understand what we might idealize as a social, or what we're working towards before we can really address whether or not certain things are valuable or advantageous.
That raises like the issue of, well, maybe it doesn't. Maybe I should have
Be more careful where I speak.
I feel like I need to get back to my sort of fantasy of New York school.
Yeah, that's what you really feel about
when I was referring to there with Alan.
We were just talking about different generations, I'm sorry.
No, my
misunderstanding.
No, it's well taken, but because it's, just getting back to what Carol said, can you just, I'm sorry, I'll wait a second.
No, I think, I guess I'm responding to initially, Josh, I'm glad that you said something that was possibly antagonistic, but, you know, you're saying that maybe we don't need to cross 10 different social codes in our poetry. Maybe, like, the one that we're really working intimately with is, you know, has its own advantages. And David, in addition to the safety that, you know, we provide one another, there's also community, which is very valuable, which is how we're all here. I mean, you know, collectivity. There are a lot of very wonderful things about investing in a single social, but, you know, so that might be like what you were saying, to use our new terms, but before we can understand what are the advantages and values of crossing as many as possible, I think that maybe we should talk about some goals.
I was wondering, how does one do that without somehow doing it and mechanically, or how does one get out, but without sort of, Emil saying to everyone, read other things and stuff like that, but then it comes like this sort of multicultural quilt that you're supposed to somehow drape around yourself. I'm wondering.
But that is activism, right? It is labor.
It's a start. But to me, I'm wondering if there's a better, a more somehow intimate way to proceed through that stage than just
or not necessarily intimate, but you talk about goals. And I think what's interesting to me anyway, listening to everyone speak, is how we haven't yet, and perhaps this is what you're pointing out, raised this issue of what are our goals, which to me, I immediately think of a word like, you know, ethics, or what is the social command in the sense of what are our goals in the sense of, well, social justice, socioeconomic justice, etc., and how do we engage those, that sort of set of slogans of commands in ourselves as agents and writers. But what's fascinated me is that, in fact, that has been all implicit. We haven't needed, in some way, to organize the manifesto, you know, in point form of you know, the type of social justice we're talking about and the better world that we want. And I think that is very, very interesting to me, to keep in some sense that open, rather than, I mean, and to keep that end of things specific. I mean, that to me is very context specific, what the goals are.
So do you think it's a liability to outline them?
Well, that's what we've done historically, right? We've understood agenda in these grandiose terms, right? This sort of meta-narrative of ethics. And I think we are managing fine so far without having to bring that ghost back.
Say, now I'd like to say something antagonistic. No, because I just really sat through a discussion with Michael Empire Hart, 2.5 hours, where all he did was keep the horizon open, and that's why people love it, because it's like, forget the determinate, forget the material, it's the multitude, and it's like, okay, but, you know, what who is that? But she's like, yeah, good question. Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, yeah, that's great that we don't have to name who that would be.
But aren't those very specific goals?
Hmm?
Those are... Just go on.
No, but I'm saying, so we had, like, this open horizon of the empire. A placeless, spaceless empire. With an open horizon. But somehow functioning through power. And then the next week we had a paper that was a critique of the anti-globalization movement, which said that what it tried, the argument was that the anti-globalization movement, as opposed to an anti-capitalism movement, tries to keep this ideological horizon, let's say, open, because if you formulate goals, like if you have like goals at the end of this horizon, then antagonisms on how to reach them would arise within the process. And that would be, and then everyone's so afraid of the ghost of the old left, afraid of the ghost of totality. I mean, like yesterday, and I was joking, like my inner Stalin is coming out. And I was saying, you know, it's like we're so afraid of like stepping forward in a sense, and we're crushing other people's positions. And in a sense, you end up with this placeless, spaceless empire. That, I mean, most people who I know who are doing organizing, anti-capitalist organizing, just think that the anti-globalization movement is going to fall apart at the next social forum. Because it's already falling into like representational bickering. So without a social goal at the end of the horizon, in a sense, then you just end up with a process which ends up being spaceless, which ends up being open form, which to me is like a return to the poetics of the 80s, where it's like, you know, this process is going to transform you, whether you know it or not.
I think that's the thing, you know, in bringing up Brecht, you know, is that a lot of the language poets, you know, I remember having dinner with Barrett Watton after he had gotten back from Germany and showing pictures of, like, Bertolt Brecht's doorbell, you know, and, like, kind of documenting the whole thing.
Well, he is a materialist.
But, you know, Brecht had these certain ideas about agency, you know, and so by kind of structuring these plays in a certain way and then writing particular plays for workers' theaters, that there would be some dot on that horizon, you know, like something would happen because of the work that they had done. And I also think, you know, between the sort of the hermeticism and the methods, is that another thing that always worries me is that, like if we start talking about the methods, that it dangerously gets us in this position of like having like innovation being how are we being innovative formally from a certain point, you know, and that point tends to be this line of like Pound, Whitman, Zukofsky, Oppen, the language poets, the New York School, et cetera, and then what is erased from that line, you know? So like one of the things that happens is you get this thing that happened at Smell Press Traffic, the Indigenous Writing Now, the Native American Writing Conference, in which like nobody shows up. I mean, it's like this sort of, you know, there's a few younger poets, there's no one from the older generation shows up. And there's no dialogue because everyone's in their little
That's a social imagination too. Right. It's like here's your particularized struggle and welcome to it. Fight the good fight. I'm busy right now.
Right. And I think part of it too is the piece that you had, there was just a phrase about relationship marketing, you know. And it's like the Native American poets, for example, by and large, almost exclusively, aren't publishing in the presses that are distributed by SPD. And so they're not ending up in blogs, you know, and they're not being written about, and they're not being discussed. And so because they're publishing on, like, University of Nebraska Press, University of Oklahoma Press, Michigan State University Press, you know, and others, that they sort of are just completely eliminated from the discussion, you know, because they're not, like, pastiche, cobbled, you know, I mean, they're working against a different, a kind of wider tradition, you know, and so it's dangerous because, like, I think we need to have these sort of multiple points
combined
from which, right, you know, that uneven development thing.
You brought up this really interesting thing last night, too, about this Vietnamese, or is it Cambodian?
Cambodian
writer who you published in one of the early XCPs and got a lot of flack for it. Mm-hmm. Because this guy was writing, was using narrative or something mm-hmm. like this, and you know, how is this you know, challenging anything like so conservative, right? Meanwhile, the guy is writing against a Cambodian tradition of metered verse, and so it, how can we think about, you were saying, you know, how can we call that not, you know, a political act because it's not falling into this particular chain of writers. So like, and that, you know, maybe I don't know if scale is the same thing as uneven cultural terrain, but it sort of sounds like one way of understanding that difference. And is it possible to go, you know, to have this multiple without like eliding something and without being a quilt, without being a multicultural quilt, because it's, we do have a political social end view, even if it's not articulated. So, I mean, why, you know, how, it's not just like, hey, inclusion just because, hey, we need, you know, it's, I think it's
one of the branch plant in Cambodia for poetics.
Well, yeah.
Actually,
well, he's here, so.
I'm going to, I'm just in the course of talking this morning and actually after thinking about the reading, which I thought was really great last night, actually, I thought it was really. A great totality, and I'll use totality in a positive term here.
I'll get you ready.
And then Alan, you get me ready.
But, you can wait.
Well, I could say structure. But what I thought arose was two levels of solidarity, in a sense. And, and I'm sort of proposing this because often we're trained to totally recognize differences, but without working towards whether it's that end point on the horizon, but also, you know, being shied away from larger structures which come under the rubric of meta-narratives or something like that. But the two unifying things that I thought happened last night in the works, and that I think have really interesting social consequences, and also posing a kind of social cultural logic. There's one that I think we would all agree quite easily that there's like a counter-hegemonic push to all of the work, whether people are using similar forms or not, or whether it's at the level form, content, address, imagined audience, constructed audiences, self-reflexivity of the writer. But the other thing that I thought very powerfully rose up was a movement away from a valorization of and almost a fetishization, I'll say, of the fragment and of the shard. And actually, even though everybody's work could be called disjunctive or fragmented in some way, and Mark, maybe it would be a little more difficult to think of you, your work in that way, but certainly how you're trying to tie together different views and say of this same event within, that could even be seen in a sense of working with different fragments. But what I found was really socially exciting about it was the movement towards some kind of whole, which I'll say is a kind of totality. Because I think that proposes that from, in a sense, that the poetic form proposes a really larger functional view of the social form. So not just to make a micro and macro connection, but as a kind of cultural logic. It seemed to me a very clear instance of Turner, in a way of like away from the modernist shard or fragment that's supposed to contain the whole, and against, or that's to say, away from, or with a kind of confidence, away from disjunctiveness that valorizes itself because it's not unified, but towards the recognition of disjunctiveness instead of heterogeneity, let's call it uneven development.
Right.
And towards a kind of social logic, not of necessarily networking, but of articulations across all the different ways that people have characterized their work. But I'm trying as a social logic, and that very much goes against ideas of, not very much goes against, but I think it provides a productive model of social organizing that is not so frightened of the dot on the horizon, as Mark said, or some contentiously posing as a kind of totality, or a hegemonic formation, because hegemony is only bad if you're under it. You know?
Yeah.
So that to me was like an amazing optimistic moment, and that to me is the value of the cultural within the social, because so many of the social meetings that I sit in each week, this is the argument, it's like, how do we create some kind of functional totality, I'll say, and then versus how do we have an open network, and you can just see those two things struggling. So you know, the Marxists around Monthly Review are saying, well, the anti-globalization movement's going to fold because they're frightened of any totality that's actually going to seize any power. Right? You know, how many times have you heard these kinds of arguments? And then the network-based people are like, man, I'm not going to get involved in anything that, you know, sets up a hierarchy and then shuts down, you know, potential options. And, you know, I'm just here to dance with the, you know, I'll characterize it in a funny way, but I'm here to dance with the paper mache puppet kind of thing, and that's what I value about anti-globalization. So I thought that, in fact, through the use of poetry, maybe as a site or a space, that we actually came up with a cultural logic that has some function to it in a way. You know, not that it's going to be a micro-macro jump, but I think one thing is laying the ground of a cultural logic.
That's nice, Jeff. One thing that really surprised me in hearing everyone read last night is how many of us are using repetition in various but very effective ways. And to me, what I felt like is that there was a unified sense of urgency. And there are all these cultural phenomena happening that where I think that each of us evidenced we don't want to forget. And in repeating various linguistic phrases, we're really incorporating lots into a media, lots into a language. And so I think that what really struck me in one poem is like a sense of urgency. And it's interesting, and you're talking to me about how the anti-globalization movement is predicted to possibly fall apart, because one thing that kind of always astounds me about a lot of language poets saying that poets in our generation are not political is that politics looks very different now. So I don't even necessarily understand why we need to view effectiveness as one, you know, it's a certain kind of unification that's being discussed that I think is maybe off the mark. There are lots of ways to unify, and I think that in smaller voices, we're going to find that there are patterns of unification.
Can I read a paragraph from this Jameson essay relating to this, since Lord knows we put a lot of time just into printing these things out?
We all have
I've learned your tone or part of your work, I must say. So I feel like maybe just every once in a while we can return very specifically to these. And this is tied into the debate over the anti-globalization protests. And I think it also maybe helps segue a little bit into the panel and the need, or maybe not the need, to think about certain, imagine the social, how we imagine the social, and whether or not that needs to be presented. This is bottom of page 65 of Jameson, globalization essay. Finally, very provocative claim. Finally, one has to add that the nation state today remains the only concrete terrain and framework for political struggle. The recent anti-World Bank and anti-WTO demonstrations do seem to mark a promising new departure for a politics of resistance to globalization within the U.S. Yet it is hard to see how such struggles in other countries can be developed in any other fashion than the nationalists' spirit I've evoked above. The spirit he evokes above is Dahlism, particularly French resistance to American imperialism, which has a history. You know, I didn't realize this stupidly, maybe, that de Gaulle refused to join NATO in the
68.
In 68.
Back then.
But I mean, yeah, before that, he refused to join NATO because he didn't want his nuclear weapons under U.S. implicitly under U.S. command. Yet it's hard to see how such struggles in other countries have been developed in any other fashion than the nationalist, that is to say, Gaullist spirit I've evoked above. For example, in fighting for labor protection laws against the global free market push, in the resistance of natural cultural protectionist policies, or the defense of patent law against an American universalism that would sweep away local culture and pharmaceutical industries, along with whatever welfare safety net and socialized medical assistance might still be in place. Here, the defense of the national suddenly becomes the defense of the welfare state itself. That's Jameson's take.
But I would break that up into aspects. That was, you know, the fuzzy things you can put into a political discussion, you know, this, having this aspect and that aspect, whatever. But I wouldn't say defending the national so much as defending, you know, national provision. Mm-hmm. You know, I would actually quantify, like, what is being, or qualitatively define what is being defended. Like, in the sense of, like, in vis-a-vis privatization, like in Mexico, for example, you'd be defending, you know, the nationalized structure of the railways because you're able to access that wealth as an aggregate. So you could say, we're against deregulation of the railroad industry or whatever. But that, to me, does not equate to defending the national. And this is the argument that I've been having with Eddie Lefebvre-Yepes, mm-hmm. is that he's suggesting sort of a defending the national culture, the national entity of Mexico, so without locating specifically where those pockets of sort of struggle over wealth, where it's accumulated, where you can actually have access to it, and deploy that wealth, you know, not only economically but culturally, or related to that to that economy, and so that in that fragment of James, that's what's missing to me, is that qualitative definition of what's national, not just.
Yeah.
Does that make, to my,
yeah, yeah, I mean, I don't think Jared James is a nationalist.
You know, what's that?
He's not a hardcore nationalist, but he's looking
for
the kind of boundaries to the, like, you know, like Jeff's saying, if empire is just this open horizon, where are you going to create the boundaries of resistance in there? You know, I mean, we know Benedict Anderson's texts. I mean, you know, there are rich histories of nationalism as a resistant project. But of course, there's the finest of line between.
In fact, nationalism as an ideology is really, really hurting.
Pardon me?
Nationalism as a sort of ideology is really, really hurting a lot of national struggle. Like, in, like specifically Mexico, it has a very distorted effect on worker struggle.
Well,
it's a post-colonial legacy.
Yeah, who's nationalism?
What's that?
Who's nationalism?
Yeah.
Fanon's notion of nationalism is very different than, you know, the same thing thought. But I mean, just another, you know, ideological struggles.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of his appetite, isn't, you know.
What's the quality of him to Fox? Completely neoliberalism.
Yeah, absolutely. But he's able to invoke an ideology of nationalism.
Yes.
In the same way, forms of cultural. Jameson was at Santa Cruz. He was in the fall. Part of that is, slightly exaggerating, but, he wants there to be Chinese film and Iranian film, and he wants, some good national film industry because he likes international cinema. I mean, there's this, this kind of, which, yeah, if it's not more complex than that, then, it's not.
This to me is where the scale debate, that's right outlined in the one I posted, is actually really practical. In a way. And it's like, why would the national always be the appropriate scale? Why would you limit your options to that?
Well, it's not either or, right? That's what I was going to say about the Baptiste is one of the many interesting things about where they articulate the scale of their own project, or the horizons are simultaneously quote unquote local in terms of regional autonomy, and then at the level of the nation state in terms of Mexico and reclaiming various, let's say shadow histories of various Mexican nationalisms that have been marginalized, and then the global or the multinational terrain, sort of simultaneously, I think very very effectively being able to make those linkages, which is at least a potential, and which in my writing about Zapatistas and thinking in terms of these kinds of new, quote unquote, new social movement formations as having a kind of poetics, and in this case, like paying attention to uneven development, simultaneity of local and global struggles, and then starting to rethink about quote unquote anti-globalization movements, and their plurality and diversity as having their own poetics in of themselves, in terms of this attempting to simultaneously, obviously it's like local versus global, but the different simultaneity of different scales and terrains of struggle. It can't work, quote unquote work, but it works because it's happening. It works how it works, and trying to think of that in terms of using the logic of poetics, at least as I understand it, as a way of sort of trying to look at it's another way of saying, we are fragmented and particularized, and there are logics that do that, and we participate in complicit. Then what?
Yeah, right.
Not like, okay, well, we have to unpack that and get back to find that unified, which is already been co-opted as global sort of multiculturalism, right?
I thought that was the poetics that was emerging last night.
Yeah, not a fetishization of the fragment for the fragment, but we can see that it exists, that it's a cultural legacy.
It doesn't have to be endlessly argued for.
Yeah, when you talk about this last night, that's been one, and now, that's the project of our generation. It's like, okay, then now what?
This is a practical question. What would, in this kind of descriptive terms, of what would a poetics of the Nazi globalization project look like?
That's the question. That's my question.
I would say there's a thing about, it's interesting this division you brought up about sort of like an anti-capitalist sort of movement and anti-globalization. And I think that there's, yet again, there's an aspect of the anti-globalization movement that is becoming anti-capitalist, because I think the great thing about the anti-globalization movement was it was able to sort of look at things in terms of democratic issues, like democracy, right? Like class democracy, and to continuously pose things in those terms rather than sort of like this, antagonism or the agony of struggle over social or global wealth at the level of the nation and the liberation and the front kind of formations and stuff like that, and also it was good because you know, here's Capital coming along and saying, you know, these are the biggest ways that we're going to organize, what the WTO or, you know, regional like FTA, and this is what, the way we're going to do it, and there's a convergence on that, and people saying from all different directions and saying no to that, and that's very unique, I think, for our time, and I think that for a long time, hopefully we'll still be building on that sort of converging on central.
Like the
arbitrate, you know, like with Capital's going to arbitrate
it
as well centrally. What's that?
If it was like the MIA, the multilateral.
Yeah, multilateral agreement on investment. Yeah,
which is a massive victory, but, you know, doesn't get talked about anymore.
Massive.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, huge.
Yeah.
The multi.
Investment.
What's it?
International.
International Agreement on Investment.
Yeah.
That was the one
in
Ottawa, right? It was, I forget where it was finally, it was like one of these world forum things, you know, but it was essentially going to free up immaterial capital from any anchoring, any spatial anchor, particularly the nation state. And then it's been countered with the so-called Tobin? Tobin tax, which is, was it 1% or 2%?
Yeah, on financial.
I feel like 2 years ago, I don't know how you guys feel, you guys were all part of the movement in terms of the globalization of that whole question. You know, ideologically, we were getting the upper hand, you know? Like, a corporate, like, power is getting a bad name broadly, like, in a way that, like, you could only imagine, like, 5 years before, mm-hmm. you know?
And so that's the most exciting thing to happen in 30 years, I think.
Yeah, and I feel like interrupted, obviously, by this. So this is a very unique moment.
It also got weirdly interrupted by the fact that those prophecies suddenly came true a year later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, the actual collapse of these companies and the scandals in these companies bumped from the headlines.
Yeah.
They bumped the protest against these companies. It's kind of a weird. I don't know if that's good or bad. It's probably bad in the end. Because it gives them an excuse to, as they always try to do, to bump resistance, the pervasiveness of resistance from the headlines, but nevertheless.
I have a little quote that's actually in my piece from the MAI meeting in Quebec. This is since 2000, like 2000. This is Bush, and he said this in Spanish, La libertad no es negociable. First of all, why he felt the need to say it in Spanish. But liberty, and that's a quote from Jose Marti, right, and invoking this notion of liberty is not negotiable. In other words, you know, what is free trade? It's free, limited. And as lead negotiator, publicly concerned, the trans-border regulations might be seen as, quote, new forms of colonialism.
That was before colonialism was a positive term again.
Right. Well, that's the next line. Craxiata, better to stick to the old forms. And then Bush again, no codicils. Did I say that? Codicils. To destroy the spirit of free trade. This is anything. Destroy the spirit, right? But yeah, when liberty and, we don't want to colonize with regulations.
Also the word solidarity, the way that Clinton used it 5 or 6 years ago, remember, was it El Salvador? Calling for social solidarity. That was when he started saying social solidarity, he really meant austerity, which means that you get, workers and peasants organization to buy in and share the burden of the national debt.
Participatory economies and
participatory yearnings, that's why
you're
poor.
Well, Clinton was really the first one to just totally conflate free markets with democracy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's his legacy that, it was certainly the conservative ideology, and when Reagan railed against the evil empire, was his vaguely Alzheimer's. Who used the phrase Alzheimer's ridden yesterday? That's very good.
Alzheimer's what?
Someone was saying Reagan, it's Mark. Alzheimer's ridden presidency. I mean, amazing, these stories they used to bring Reagan, these pictures of like two rows of tanks, like with five tanks in one row and one tank in the other one, and they're like, which one do you want? And you point at the picture of the five tanks. I mean, that's like how policy was carried out in the later years of the Reagan administration. But it's really Clinton. I mean, Clinton was the one who made that conflation. Specifically did in terms of Eastern Europe, and I don't know if anybody read the Perry Anderson thing that I made the link to, but the legacy of, according to Perry Anderson, this legacy of overthrowing national sovereignty that Bush is
Bush Jr. is in the process doing right now was really set in stone in the Clinton administration.
We regard it very highly. I think it's like this participatory democracy, you know, whether at the local level or, you know, but it's like, it's very, very slick, you know, all this thing that's going on, like in Porto Alegre, you know, this participatory budgets and participatory compacts. It's making you seem like, you know, you're not willing to share the burden, you're anti-communalistic, you're, you know, all this business. And it's all that sort of cud, ideological cud, is floating around.
It's like meanwhile, the IMF, they're still being paid, so the participatory aspect is in divvying up whatever remains, which is hardly anything.
Right.
So it's not the real question of economic imperialism never comes up. Like the paradigm never comes up.
Yeah. And so
you participate in, you can either have healthcare or education.
Right.
But it's your choice.
Right.
That's the beauty. There's this beautiful Lenin essay called the Zizek. This one has a nice summary of Lenin's two types of freedom, which is one that's actual. There's two. One is a formal freedom. Another one's an actual freedom. So the formal freedom is like, what would you like, healthcare or education?
Right, or voting.
Yeah, and then the actual freedom would be the freedom to transform the context or the social relations under which you get to make your choice. And I mean, a joke about that, and actually not a joke, I guess it's unfortunately real. It's in the text I read last night, which is, did the internet vote on the name of the president's cat, or was it the dog? You know, and then that stands in for types of freedom and for participation.
I'm sorry.
Carol?
Oh, no, I was just going to say quickly, and that happens because our media is economized, and Jill and I were talking about, like, human interest stories, that we, you know, that the mainstream channels play because they're cheap. And so, to just sort of return to possibly a goal, and what I'm hearing in some way form in my head is that one thing that we might do in poetry in addressing social issues, perhaps not these social, but social issues, is informing our text with the consciousness that will foster culture and continue to propel our, our political action, because I think that probably the most powerful thing that we can do is instill belief that we actually have many more victories to go, instead of saying, like, well, it's going to fall apart because this and this. I mean, because as soon as you introduce pessimism, people are afraid to show up because nobody wants to be on a losing team, kind of thing. You know, so I think that that's a very powerful vehicle returning to the notion of poetry as media.
Words around which all of these discussions have taken place. Would that be a good way to start, or is that going to get us off into a brain?
So, me, I'm so, you know how I am.
You know how I am, honey.
For example, the ones that I have starred, and maybe other people wouldn't agree, and that's totally fine. But
I think the people who need to do that should read it. And, you know,
I think the idea, though, is.
But could I say what I was going to say, first? Honey? You know how I am.
Honey, I shrank the video.
I mean, this could be very wrong. But what I have is this notion of scale and or uneven development, uneven cultural training as one.
We're using uneven development in a purely negative way, right?
Yeah.
No, it's purely negative.
I think I see it as a purely negative term.
So do I.
Okay.
How would you see it?
Well,
scale would be what we're offering as a kind of critical counter model of engagement to uneven development. Uneven development is.
Well, if we're talking about uneven, using that term uneven development, the term under the condition of capitalism.
Especially in a public situation present act as if we were presenting uneven development as any kind of
I'm just saying that around these terms are what we could articulate, mm-hmm. whatever this poetic mm-hmm. this, I don't know.
In our conversation this morning, it seems to me, I'm sorry if I'm policing terms because it's really not my style at all, but it seems to me that uneven development occasionally drifted over into like a term that we use to describe a model of scale or, I don't know, maybe it didn't, maybe that was...
Well, in my thinking, uneven development means that we need the concept of scale to understand how to... articulate, to use just a movement between these spheres, and a way to counter uneven development.
Okay,
can I just bring up a problem of form up here? And maybe this doesn't go chemist, you know, this is confluence with what you're saying. But I see this, if we start writing a paragraph.
No, I'm just talking about terms right now.
Well, I like these terms. So scale.
So like if we have, this is one. Well, just let me lay it out, and then it's fine if we don't want to do it, but this is just what I was thinking. Scale, uneven development, uneven cultural terrain. The idea of the fragment, not as a goal in and of itself, but as the terrain on which we're working, and so then what does that mean?
Can you wait for us
to get paper?
Get this in a different way.
Yeah. Also, Laura, I really appreciate this, because I think that, and Louie, maybe I'm totally wrong, but for the panels, had you envisioned that there would be, like, questions or topics? At least it started off
like the questions from the panel,
from us, perhaps, is, like, topics that we might want to address as...
Well, it seemed like yesterday we were talking about subgroups working on specific themes, but it seems that now I'm not sure if that's what we're doing.
How did you envision, though, that the panels, like... I'm not really sure that I understand exactly what the panels are going
to
be.
It seems to me, in my sense, it's changed quite a bit. And so right now, I'm not sure what...
I just wanted to sort of tie up this conversation in some summary form, and then we can figure out
the
panels.
Idea of how we're going to do the panel.
Am I being too bullish?
No.
So what's our adjective for scale? It's not just scale, it's what?
Critical scale?
What was the critical use, Jack?
Did I use a phrase?
I used a phrase. It's in your piece. It's not just scale, it's something scale. What is it?
What the scale debates, or...
I'm just trying to get a buzz.
The scale arguments.
Critical scale. Okay, critical scale versus uneven
critical
development.
Critical notions of scale in order to...
Versus...
Well, I think, why uneven development is useful, because it is... As one terrain of contestation is, A, it's not really been addressed that much in recent poetics. I mean, it's just coming in, but that it's very useful in talking about globalization and getting beyond this way.
Global,
or that we talk about semantic scale as another way to talk about poetics of place and not have that mean simply, you know, the Olson tradition, but other ways of talking about spatiality, in uneven terms.
The second one, and these are just I'm sure there's others, but the other one, the fragment, the idea of the fragment not as a goal and as a thing in and of itself, not as a, but as the terrain on which we're working. So, I mean, it's related to scale. But
for me, that's a shift from, remember the old term, disjunctive poetry, which got kicked around for a while, and then I tried to make a counter-argument to that, conjunctive poetry.
So what would we say, people said, as the cultural terrain, as the cultural logic, fragments?
Jeff called it that, cultural or social.
Well,
I ask you about that there.
Logic
of articulation. But we could, how about just cultural articulation or articulatory poetics or...
Yeah, like a cultural logic. I thought, to me, a cultural logic emerged out of the poetics, a cultural logic emerged, and vice versa, obviously, the poetics.
Cultural logic, Bob's going to think we're going to start talking about China.
Well, we already talked about China, so let's see.
I'm sorry. I just want to add this. This is fine. I just want to add this. That the conversation that we had I mean,
it's very fluid.
In the way that we had it, streaming
is
likely to pull in more people in the audience. If we sort of construct, we're like, what is that? What is that cultural? We're gonna. It seems like we're gonna. There's like some text somewhere that we're like referring to, and we're like, what was that? No, I thought you were. And it's like.
Well, I would.
Summarizing.
I'm just summarizing. Yeah, right. So I would imagine that,
in addition to it, because I just want to add that.
We wouldn't say.
It's a starting point, not an end point.
Okay.
In other words, we're not gonna get up there and say these are our four conclusions, and you know these are the. But just that they might be.
Stalin might.
I'm still meeting for the group today.
Right. So they might be like a cluster around which a more.
It'd be good to have something to return to, having sat on many and through many a rambling panel. Just have a few things to return to if we get lost.
We're running out of gas.
So let's see. I also have here.
We didn't come to. What are we calling that thing?
Politics of the dragon.
As cultural terrain or cultural logic, not as an end goal. In other words, not a fetishization of the fragment.
But isn't it part of the title of the most famous essay in postmodernism?
Yeah, cultural logic.
Yeah.
Cultural logic.
Look at that.
Cultural politics of the fragment.
But there could be some of the themes of what we're talking about.
Okay, here's what he is.
To represent.
I'm going to say social logic.
Fuck it.
Well, I think that if we call it either a cultural, if we keep the term logic, then it allows us to address the question that Josh brought up earlier, and that how do we evidence a more extensive cultural community, cultural consciousness in our poetry without it being mechanical, without it seeming artificial, I think is the objection really, right? So, I think
social logic
or
articulation.
Yeah, and the notion of logic that it also then runs through the work, just not simply the work as addressed.
Right, exactly, yes.
Okay, so then I also had this idea of, and maybe, I don't know, this is very good, of the cultural and economic, we set up that series, cultural, economic, social. And how sometimes a culture and economic collapse, and then you lie the social, and this whole discussion about, you know, why poetry or why the cultural. So what can we call this? I mean, is this a separate point, or is this part of these two things?
Well, what's elided there is the argument of form as it's worked out in a reception. I mean, I think that was something, anyway, a theme we talked about at the beginning.
Which ties perception then ties to the audience, the institutions of networks and communities of interpretation.
And that would be what's collided in this cultural equals the economic.
Right.
Something around that. Says.
So.
Like alternatives to the economic cultural nexus. Because Louis, you want to address the level of form.
Well, I like that, this phrase, argument of form, as worked out through reception, but that might just be my own.
I like that idea of the reception.
Is that too abstract? I mean, you're sort of too...
Well, as negative, like I suggested that it would be understood as
negative reception.
Right.
Negative reception.
I don't know. To me, I don't understand. The only reason I understand that is because I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Well, that's a good point.
No, I know.
Negative reception. I wouldn't.
Right. But I mean, these are very general things to start with. The notion of the problematics around the issue, but issues of reception.
Yeah. That's a logic to me. In part, form worked out through reception. Acknowledge the importance of logic, dialectic steps, getting somewhere.
It could be problematics of reception that have certain subcategories, institutional, audience, form, various things like that.
Mm-hmm. What did you just say?
So problematics of reception, and then it can be form, institutional, audience, you know, various ways, the various contexts in which poetry is received.
And
culture is received.
Yeah. And you mentioned that
notion of networking, like in the urge to merge, I mean, how we're talking about that way. And that, because originally we were talking about like this, you know, reaching out and crossing, getting out of the poetry box.
Outreach.
You know, outreach, but then, of course, fence is outreach too, right?
Right. So, right. Like, this is still exhausting.
No, so all things are on that.
It's just the resistive aspect.
What did
you
say?
Resistive aspect.
The
collapse? Or?
How do I put that? How do I put what you put that part about that in this reception? What should I call that?
Network.
Outreach. Network.
The part about fence?
The part about it not just being the idea of,
I see that as resistance in some ways. Or withdrawal in some ways, like in terms of what you, the essay.
What about, you have the populace. What about Alan made the point early on about poetry for me as more populist? Or problematic reception at one point is populist.
Well, this would tie into what Mark was saying. I mean, that this idea that our only kind of immediate cultural inheritance as poets is a, what we could generally probably call kind of a high avant-garde tradition or classical avant-garde tradition.
Hey, you're
and, you know, I think everyone in this room, you know, Mark has been doing serious research into kind of, you know, what might then be called more populist forms of cultural transmission, whether that's, obvious example, something like that.
It's who the someone is when you reach out and touch someone. Right? So who's that someone at the end of the reaching out?
Right, and
what Lundy was is a leader, which is the part of the response.
Okay, you reach out and touch them.
Was a stun gun or
and this would help with, you know,
and what Rodrigo was saying, which was that each of the someones are many, have many. Or is many. Each of the someones are many someones.
Touching the multi.
Yeah.
Someone's
touching the multi. Reach out and touch someone else.
So populism is alternative cultural traditions that one accesses or connects with or researches. Not in contrast to.
Or method. Maybe that ties to method.
Yeah,
because you mentioned.
Yeah, but it's parallel to this more literary avant-garde tradition that we're kind of expected to be the inheritors of and carry on the torch of, which I guess some people are not.
Yeah, so it's also a question of not just like the audience, not just reception, not just who you're writing for, but who. The productive side of that, then. Mm-hmm. I mean.
The equity active.
So you're.
Construction.
Right, you're constructing.
Sure.
Well, I thought the word transmission is pretty interesting because that does have a sense. I mean, politics of transition are like Regis Debray's book on mediation, or mediology, as he calls it, which has both active and both about the productive act and the politics of reception. That, you know, and it ties in, we haven't really talked about it, but like this would be that piece on transmission, or we haven't really talked about some of the things that Mark brought up with Solomon's blog and stuff in terms of, I insert populism, I think of Gramsci's notion of the national popular, I'm trying to think, theorize the transnational popular. I don't know what to do with that yet. Yeah, the slogan. But
Spivak has another nice slogan of the trans. I think she calls it transnational literacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Which I think at the end of the essay, mm-hmm. I just did a scale jumper. Yeah. And it was on global literacy. Yeah. It really ties into media, like poetry.
Or I mean,
it's
trans localism. I mean, what it is, don't worry about the.
Well, yeah, this is the idea of politics of reception, the productive act, the idea of negativity.
Because obviously, we've been talking about reception, not just sort of, we already know what we do, and so let's figure out how it gets received at X, Y, and Z, but how those factor into how you actually produce. And when you're talking about getting outside of your own little hermetic fields and doing this kind of quote unquote reaching out, and also the shout out, right? You know, investigative poetics, counter memories and histories, and, you know, calling the different constituencies into being in the work is also a kind of translation.
And the idea that everything can be thought of as a shadow, not just like saying.
That's what a fragment is.
Right.
I mean, if you're using it critically,
that's an interesting way of saying,
you know, that have that quarter chunks of the real, which is like if you rip something out and you put it here, you know, again, if we want to make a distinction between previous notions of understandings of the fragment and like the example of what's that?
It's called fluffing or whatever,
right? Yeah. You know, like
I just thought this one was words that
that would be a really
good way to start. No, it's a way of writing that some people in New York have been writing, like Keith Mohammed and Gary Sullivan and Nina Gordon.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, and it wasn't meant to be such a pointed critique on their work. I was just questioning the notion of not being discriminating or sort of letting that go. You know, what does it mean to not to let go of discrimination of terms for like, you know, 3 pages at a time, when you're actually dealing with lexicons that are very specifically marked, if you will, socially, right, and you know, loaded, not examining, and you know, dramatically what that might be doing, and the end point of that would be, exacerbating, the uneven cultural terrain. I mean, why, what is that? What's that politic? Why are you exacerbating?
In the name of a kind of populism.
In the name of creativity.
And that's what Louis is saying when he says this idea of form coming through this reception through lexical, affective
registers.
Not form as like, you know, formalism. Like,
yeah.
I think that Eddie Guthrie said something really nice the other night about his student said, all writing is graffiti. And I think that that's a very clear way to understand the lexicons that we're integrating with. And like, it allows us to also bring up the questions of how are we locating the walls on which we're writing, and how are we integrating our new, our new inscribings over our histories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe some mention.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Oh, I wasn't.
Should we make some mentioning of the social code idea that we talked about earlier? Or none of this has to be mentioned, but I also like Carol's idea, which she's mentioned a couple of times, this idea of poetry as media. That kind of shifts the terms in a little way that maybe eventually I'd like to try and pin down a bit, but I think that's a provocative way of finally rethinking poetry's role just a little bit. Poetry's media.
I'll just make a link to that to
poetry's alternative media.
To an epigraph in Louis' book, The Need of Boston, which is poetry as information.
Yeah. I mean,
but the networks in which it's propagated, do or do not reflect the kind of the same way, information and media is propagated. And more crucially, the idea of stepping into those spaces, where the media is somehow managed to leave a gap.
So that we don't qualify it as alternative anymore. We just assert that this is media and where is Pat Flo's, where is occupying is there.
Well, and even at this time, just to do its fucking job, which it's not doing.
Yeah.
So could we say, poetry is media, or the cultural, or the production of cultural media? Well,
I think this poetry
is good. It's provocative.
It's absolutely tied to this notion of transmission. Media is not the same as mediation. And it's another way to break down that divide. The poetry is somehow, capital P poetry, is
right,
this distinctive thing over here. It's just another form of working with them, and especially under the politics of fragment, it's another way of working with shards of information.
And so the social code is also that.
Well, we were trying to switch from hermetics, different.
Oh, sure, sure.
Every community had a hermetic, so we changed that to social code.
It seems like we're still kind of folding the summary with the anticipatory feelings we have about this public. One thing that underscores, just a cautionary flag, is that this thematic summary is great, but I'm worried about sort of presenting this, like Rodrigo was saying earlier, I think, as kind of like
some sort of platform, to use your word, when I think a if we were to do that, we would be overlooking the very reception of that information given to people who might come to this panel. Because I think everything I've heard now, I would try and imagine myself, you know, as someone who's hearing this for the first time. It doesn't strike me, even the phrase poetry as a media, as particularly specific or sort of renovating older ideas, or, and that's not in any way to take away from the way that the process, the way that we've been talking through these terms over the last couple of hours, which I think has been in some ways more important than the metathematic sort of endpoint here. And
I think you guys are going to know where
to go. Let me just add a bit. That's what I meant by, like, I didn't mean to sort of evoke this notion of the open empire type of thing, but I think this the dialogic, processual approach to notions of constructing an argument about form through reception is to me, it's really important. It's an important way to engage a context such as the one that might be happening this afternoon. Is, in other words, to elicit a sense of who is there, to get the sort of like a discussion going with those, in other words, who are in the audience.
Right.
Because I think our agenda is specific. The goals are specific and concrete and imminent within our specific practices. Like, we don't need to sort of like do a, like a point manifesto, which is, to me, it's evoking like the old sense of the Leninist slogan, when it's implicit in every single line, virtually.
What I like about these three is that they're very sort of general, in that most of what we've talked about can get complicated within these three things. As like, I'm not saying that.
Like, if we could.
I'm not saying, okay, we're going to have one. We're going to talk about scale now.
Yeah.
No, but just in our own minds, like that, these are the sort of clusters
right,
around
in our own mind.
Right.
In other words, we don't even have to
bring that
use those words necessarily, but we it's an implicit understanding of what's important, and but we engage with what is given to talk from.
This can I?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this I don't see any opposition, by the way, in per se. But I also have a concern about, like, I was very sort of I really understood a lot in the way that we talked about things, the way that terms started coming up, and you know they just were really sort of really pressing and shining, and you know I could really feel them. And as we were doing the summary, you know, the social blues, you know, started to get opaque again, and I can't hear anything anymore. And so how did we get those terms to sort of become, you know, like have heat? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it has to do with the dialogic, a very close attention to the music as we're developing. And in a certain way, if we want to get to these kind of terms, almost theatrically, we're going to have in mind like the way we went through this kind of thing,
right,
and play it out, you know, and kind of just, you know.
Okay, so we
incur.
What about if we just instead of, if we just had a big circle and had, instead of points, had, one or two questions that we could
have. Yeah, just what we're doing, what we're doing is expand the conversation.
Right. That's what she's doing.
Right.
What if we could come up, if we could formulate these as questions that we could then, you know, like, pretend, like, the pretense of openness, just to get the dialogue, just the dialogue happening, you know? And because, Do you want to do that now or take a quick break and come back? Like, mull it over and
just play badminton.
Formulate these as questions.
Formulate questions.
Or don't even do that. Just have them in reserve for a point where maybe the conversation flounders, or have them in reserve
as the question.
Have them in reserve. You don't even have to start with them.
This is what I would suggest. We leave the table as it is. We don't make a circle. And we keep it in this kind of format, which has been productive. And we write on the walls as needed. Where's the audience?
People there?
No, but it just gives the appearance that we're kind of centered around the table. But
as we're working.
Yeah, that we're working, which is in fact what we've been doing. And we write on the walls the questions as we need.
Can I ask something? Sometimes part of what I do is I go out and do these worker trainings out on site or whatever. And when you talk with people and they're talking and they're I've noticed the moment you go up to the board and you write a term, it's like staring back, and all of a sudden all the dialogical talk just comes to it like dead still. And that can happen not physically writing, but if somehow people get the attention that there's a text somewhere that we've worked out a sort of canonic way of forming knowledge, that's going to be really bad, just from my experience.
But what if there is not a text that's already written on the wall that we just...
Worse. We have our backs.
Worse.
It'd be like a stage.
Can we creatively arrange the table so that the audience...
But we're giving
kind
the
of
impression that we're kind of... Sending.
Alan, I think you're hitting something.
Can we kind of just skew them and then work some chairs kind of in a little bit?
But then it's kind of this formal presentation where we're kind of readying ourselves in a line before the public.
But if we're integrated with the audience...
I think a little more... I think you're right.
What if we just started, with a... It was actually David said it yesterday, not questions, but probably not. So to say, we've been here for the last few hours, not to give you a summary of what we got to, but this is a problematic that we want to extend. Mm-hmm. And then move from there and just try and reproduce the kind of fairly open discussion that we're having.
That's what I would say. And we need to have things in reserve because, again, sure. We don't want an hour into it just so everybody's like, it's not going to happen, but I would like to have something prepared just in case. But keep it in reserve. Don't start with it. Don't set any kind of bullet points
that's
out.
Good. Yeah.
And I think hopefully people from the day, most of what has been here last night, that's another common point. Because some of these problematic, you were already experiencing some of the things I saw coming out of the work last night. And that, again, is sort of like we're trying to identify problematics and putting this notion of it. Crises that are occurring already, as opposed to programmatic notions that we have we want to apply to, to poetry or to you to listen to, but and then sort of because other people in their aspect too.
So yeah.
It's just like these are the ways we're responding to the work that's out there and trying to articulate as we hit on these problematics.
Yeah, that to me is the problematics. What arose last night out of the poetry reading that gives us an understanding. Race within my own within the relationship of the social and the cultural.
Do we want the audience to see
that? Questions coming out of out of left or right field that weren't germane to this discussion. It's going to be that unbalancing moment that's going to give us the opportunity to really sort of come forward and converge on it. I think that's right. The question is going to really
can we just explain these a little bit.
Yeah.
Just have one kind of this table just going like this, and this one kind of coming like this.
We're still facing a chevron.
A V?
Yeah.
Even a V.
Yeah,
a V. Would
the same shape as that.
A V. Yeah. And
we can do whatever we want.
The vanguard.
pointing out to the
audience. That's right.
The wedge.
We're just going to look at each other and someone feels like talking.
Someone will take position and then someone might want to find that. What do you think about a V? We could have a V and then kind of the audience.
But a V like this.
Audience.
We should be like this.
Here.
We want to be able to see each other. In other words, we don't want to point person out.
Right, sounds good.
We have a third person. Put a glance in the audience. They respond to our cues.
Yeah. That's what I'm picturing some of us being in the audience.
The CP, they always put people they're in the corner, and a corner, and a couple of free people.
Yeah.
Can I ask you one just?